from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. In this hour of Forum, author and veteran war reporter William Finnegan is here. He's reported from conflict zones around the world for The New Yorker. He's twice received an Overseas Press Club Award and the John Bartlow Martin Award for Public Interest Magazine Journalism. He's now a staff writer for The New Yorker. William Finnegan's new memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for autobiography or biography. It's a coming-of-age story, a story about male bonding as much as riding the big waves, and he'll be here to talk about all that and more. That's just ahead on Forum, and we'll get started right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. And in this hour of Forum, my guest is author William Finnegan. He's been a longtime contributor to The New Yorker, now a staff writer. He's been reporting from Africa, Central America, the Balkans, Europe, often covering conflict zones. He's twice received the John Bartlow Martin Award for Public Interest Magazine Journalism, and one of the many journalism awards that he's received. And this year, his new memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, won the Pulitzer Prize in the biography or autobiography category. Bill Finnegan, welcome to Forum.
Oh, glad to be here.
This book is really, it's a coming-of-age story. You grew up in California and Hawaii, and it's very much immersed, as you were or are, in the surf culture. But you didn't grow up with the ocean. You grew up in, I think it was Woodland Hills, sort
yeah.
of. So how did you get into surfing?
Well, I was a Val, as it was said in those days.
A Val?
A Val. Lived in the dreaded
In the valley, okay.
Yeah, San Fernando okay. Valley. But I was also sort of a beach kid. We spent summers in Newport Beach, and we're always over the hill, splashing around at Will Rogers State Park and places like that. So I sort of grew up, you know, in the ocean, which I took up surfing actually down south, a place called San Onofre.
San Diego County.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where it sits, kind of out by Camp Pendleton there. But it's a great beginner wave. It was kind of a center of surfing culture, maybe pre-war, post-war, and I sort of lucked into a family that I used to stay with down there. It was a great place to learn.
Yeah, and the book is it's a lot about male bonding as well. What is it about the surf culture? It's a very macho culture, isn't it?
Yes and no. That is, a lot of women surf now, more than when I was a kid, and in fact, there's some great women surfers, and I haven't ever been in the water with a really good female surfer. It'd be interesting to see, because it's, again, I wouldn't exactly describe it as a macho culture. It's complicated.
What do you mean it's complicated?
Well, just that there's a lot of submission in bigger waves, that is, between you and more powerful, more intense, you know, more exciting waves between you and the ocean. If you just sort of approach it with a very aggressive attitude, you're probably not going to...
You're going to be on the short end of that.
Yeah, exactly. The ocean's a lot more powerful than you. So it's a real mix. And a lot of the best surfers are kind of not necessarily brawny types. And yet there is, in a lineup with a lot of people, and unfortunately it's often kind of crowded in the water, there's lots of really basic kind of dominant submission dance, like who's bigger, who's better, who's faster, who's, you know, ready to contest the issue when it comes to waves and getting waves. And I'd love to see a woman who's really good. I mean, some of the top women surfers are better than, you know, 99% of men. And so in a given lineup, they would be the dominant figure. And I'd love to see how that plays out, but I haven't been lucky enough to see that yet.
They don't do any mixed gender competitions?
Not that I've heard of, no. No.
Yeah. You say it's not necessarily a macho culture or that it's complicated, but as you point out, there is a lot of violence in your growing up. Boxing matches on your front lawn and, you know, a fair amount of bruises and bumps and, you know, not. I think you said your parents sort of figured you got it playing football or something, but it was really more related to the kids you were growing up with. And
well, it's true. You know, looking back, because this is basically an autobiography and I was, you know, grew up in the 50s and 60s, it's quite interesting to see, you know, mid-century how much violence among kids was just accepted. You know, as you say, we'd be boxing in the street. I mean, just wailing on each other, and people would stroll by. No one would say, "Hey, you know, you can't do that." But I think the passage you're referring to, we moved to Hawaii when I was 13. I've been growing up in Southern California. That's where I learned to surf, and so I was incredibly excited that my dad got this job. And we moved to Hawaii, and I went to a junior high called Kaimuki Intermediate School. And it was quite rough. I mean, I sort of got in fights every day, it seemed like. And it was quite racialized. There were all these gangs, you know, the Samoans, the Filipinos, the Hawaiian. I mean, all these, there were many, many ethnic groups.
And there was a Haole gang, wasn't there, too?
Yeah, there was a little white gang. Yeah. I didn't know about them for a while. They called themselves the In Crowd, of all things. and eventually they asked me to join, and I gladly jumped in because they have somebody who would have my back. And that was kind of the end of my fighting career. But there was a while. I mean, I think maybe still Hawaiian public schools can be quite rough.
Yeah. And you said your dad got a job. Your dad worked in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, he was in the TV business.
Yeah, and moved to Hawaii, as I recall, working on a Don Ho kind of show.
Oh, it was a musical variety show, that first one. He did a long series of – it was based on a old Hawaiian radio program called Hawaii Calls. And then they made it into a TV show. And he said, it won't be the Hawaiian Amateur Hour, but close. It was close. Don Ho would have been the upper end of the talent.
And he worked on Hawaii Five-O too eventually,
yeah,
right? When was that? Because I remember watching that as a kid. Was that the early 70s, late 60s?
Yeah, I think that he produced Hawaii Five-O for a number of years. I think that would have been in the 70s. By then I was out of the house in college. But yeah, he developed this kind of adjunct career as the Hawaii guy. And so he had a lot of, my family was mostly there for, I don't know, 10 years.
Yeah. And the surf culture, how was it different in Hawaii from Southern California?
Mm. It was a little bit subtle, but very distinct to me. As I said, I was 13 when we moved there, and we lived in this little, kind of near the beach, near a place called Black Point on the east side of Diamond Head. Sort of obscure area in surf terms, but with waves out front, and I was, you know, incredibly excited to be out there, and the guys who surfed there really gave me plenty of space. I'd learned to surf in Ventura mainly, where if you were a little guy, you really had to stay out of the way. You know, it was much more stronger pecking order and sort of sense of staying in your place, and it wasn't true out there. And I eventually made friends with some Hawaiian brothers, the Kalakakuis. Glenn Kalakakui, who was older, was sort of a hero of mine, and his younger brother Roddy was my age, and we became best friends, and he showed me other places to surf around the reefs there that I wouldn't have been able to find. And it was I mean, there was a different style. This was in the mid to late 60s, and nose riding was quite big and on the mainland and in surfing generally, you know, hanging five, hanging 10. And that's
what is nose surfing?
Well, you know, you sort of set your board up in a certain place in the wave at a certain angle, and you cross step forward till you get to the tip, you know, to the nose. Hang five, hang 10. People have heard of that.
Okay, yes.
But that's really dated. And I was doing that, and I showed up there, and they were surfing at what turned out to be more traditional island style with knees bent more deeply. And sort of turning harder, but it turned out also to be very progressive. I mean, when there was a design revolution in 68, known as the shortboard revolution, boards suddenly got much shorter and nose riding was instantly passe. And these guys that I was surfing with, whom I was picking up, the waves are bigger and sort of more interesting in Hawaii. And I was already sort of picking up some of their style, which was good preparation for shortboards.
Why, you're about 60, I think?
63.
And you're still surfing, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But obviously it was maybe, I don't know if it was more of a passion when you were younger, but obviously, I mean, why did you take so long to write a book about surfing?
Well, I mean, most of my so-called career is writing about politics, very broadly defined, and I started freelancing in my 20s or late 20s. I'd been sort of a surf bum and aspiring novelist. I wrote several novels, all unpublished. And after a job, I had a lot of day jobs, and I spent a number of years overseas. The last of those day jobs was teaching high school outside Cape Town. This is in the early 80s, you know, bad old days of apartheid. And the students, I was at a black high school, as I say, outside Cape Town, and the students went out on strike against education in a, you know, against, excuse me, apartheid in education, and it turned into a real intense confrontation with the state, spread nationally, and I was really caught up in that. You know, our students and some of my colleagues were arrested, and it was a lot of violence. And by the end of that year, I was so caught up in the anti-apartheid struggle specifically, and sort of politics and questions of power generally, that I turned to political journalism then, and started freelancing, moved back to the U.S., went broke, you know, trying to live with my parents for a while in L.A., eventually lived here in San Francisco. But I was really mostly interested in politics, and I just sort of backed into the writing about surfing. It was something I did, but I never sort of thought about it. It was just what I did.
And you had been thinking about a book about the
No.
You
know, no. I mean, I've done a bunch of more journalistic books, and what happened was I was living here in San Francisco, and I sent a short piece to The New Yorker, a political piece, which they took, and someone in the editor's office said, you want to write longer pieces for The New Yorker, this is, you know, for the magazine, this is a good time. You got the editor's attention, which I thought meant I had, you know, 2 minutes to come up with an idea, and I did not have an idea. So I tried to think of something right off the top of my head, and I said, how about a profile of this big wave surfer, this guy I was surfing with at the time. It was a very colorful, very smart, interesting guy, and I kind of see him in the pages of The New Yorker. And maybe as a subject of like a John McPhee profile of that period, you know, these sort of colorful outdoorsmen. He was kind of a brilliant guy. And so I proposed that, and I got the assignment, and it then took me like 7 years to write. So it wasn't a straightforward thing to me, and lots of kind of inhibitions about writing about surfing. But
this is the piece with his title Diamond Head or Off Diamond Head?
That was called, they titled that Playing Doc's Games.
Oh, okay.
It was a two-part piece, and so that was my first foray. I was actually a little nervous about coming out of the closet as a surfer at that point.
Why?
I was writing about politics, including a lot of by then I'd joined the staff of I'd moved to New York and joined the staff of The New Yorker, and was writing, you know, opinion columns, so, you know, arguing public policy, foreign policy, you know, taking positions. And so I thought, well, you know, my opponents in these debates, I wouldn't really like to give them the ammunition. You know, oh, you're a surfer, you know, just another dumb surfer, you know, the stereotype, Jeff Spicoli. So I was nervous about that. It turned out to be completely needless. That is to say, nobody ever said anything like that. But I really backed into this book over a long period of time. And then it took me about 20 years to write when I did decide to write it.
Book is called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Bill Finnegan, it won the Pulitzer Prize, and it's about to come out, Bill, in paperback.
Yeah, it just did.
How? What's your sense of the industry, the book industry these days? I mean, very tough for fiction, I think. This book obviously very well received. How we were talking before the show about sort of the everything being online now and people not reading as much. I mean, how concerned are you as a writer that you know, we're going in a direction where people don't have books on their shelves anymore?
I'm not sure about that. That is. I'm not an expert, but what I hear is that print books, which were thought to be, you know, doomed, here come e-books, you know, Kindle and the rest of it. But actually, electronic books have been in some decline lately, their share of the market anyway, and print books are doing well. So in a general environment where, you know, I mean, print newspapers and magazines are really, really struggling. Obviously, loss of advertising and competition from online publications, then from themselves. I mean, we have a robust website at The New Yorker, and I write for that, and most of us are obliged to, and it's quite important to what we do now. It's print magazines and newspapers that are struggling more, I would say, than books.
Yeah. Coming back to surfing, what does it take, do you think, to excel at surfing?
It's a funny thing because sort of at a glance, it looks sort of like a sport. That's at a glance if you're looking at video. I mean, it's very photogenic, and so you see kind of spectacular stuff on video, great surfers and great waves, all that kind of thing. If you're anywhere near the ocean and you go to see guys surf, doesn't look like any. It's so boring to watch.
Well, it's often so far out, too.
It's far out. The lulls between sets are endless. I mean, it really.
Are guys talking to each other out there when they're just waiting for that, those waves? Can you even hear each other?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, and very often not. You're separated by a distance, or everybody's just kind of in their own movie, and they don't know each other, and they don't talk. It varies, but the thing itself is so solitary. You know, it's kind of you and the ocean, especially when the waves are more intense, and that. Well, you ask what it takes to excel. The main thing is sort of understanding it. As I say, it looks athletic, and there's the athletic part. You've got to, you know, paddle and catch waves and jump to your feet and ride them competently. But that you learn mainly as a kid. I mean,
Is it hard to pick it up when you're older?
Yeah, it's very hard to learn as an adult.
I took a lesson when I was, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And boy, it was, and these were little baby waves mm-hmm. down in Puerto Vallarta. Mm-hmm. And it was tough.
Yeah.
First move, you know, where you got to make that quick move and get up.
Yeah. And believe me, with age, it gets tough. It gets tougher again. But the main thing, if you get those sort of basics and can surf decently, the main thing by far is understanding what the ocean's doing, is reading waves. And that's, if you just glance down the street and see a bunch of people in the water, that's what they're doing. I mean, it's as pretentious to call it the intellectual work of surfing, perhaps, but they're just studying, trying to figure out where to be, trying to get their spot wired, as we say. And that's, you know, all conditions, tide, wind, swell direction, swell size, swell type, and then on down into, you know, like individual rocks to get, you know, a given wave so that you can really predict what's going to happen next and be in the right spot. And for a complicated surf spot, and some Ocean Beach out here in San Francisco is one of the most complicated surf spots I've ever seen.
And it's kind of dangerous too, right?
Yeah, it can get big and rough and cold in the winter, of course. And although I surf around New York a lot.
Do you really?
Yeah,
mainly
in the winter. It really gets pretty good in New Jersey and out Long Island. You can go either way. I live in Manhattan. You can kind of go either way, depending on the wind. But it's not as big or punishing as Ocean Beach. And it's colder, perhaps. But Ocean Beach doesn't have any particular landforms. It's just a long, straight sand beach. But the sandbars are always shifting. Huge currents because of the Golden Gate. And just really open to a lot of swell, and it's incredibly hard to paddle out on bigger days, and it's just, like I say, a complicated spot like that. It's like the work of a lifetime to try to get it wired, to try to really understand where to be and what's going to happen next.
What were some of the mistakes you made early on?
I've made many, and usually it's, I mean, the most consequential mistakes are thinking it'll be okay to, you know, go over there. And I'll get a wave over there before some, you know, massive wave comes and traps me there and pushes me against the cliff or whatever it might be. And then that, you know, kind of bet not panning out. It's a lot of sort
are rocks the biggest enemy?
Sometimes, yeah, or just the bottom. If it's coral or even the sand bottom can hurt if the waves are powerful enough. But generally, yeah, rocks are a big issue. And although, you know, as I say, Ocean Beach not, and yet people have close calls out there all the time.
Yeah. And what about, I know in Hawaii you surfed a lot around Diamond Head, which is more of the southeast part of the island, and also north around Waimea, I think it is. And what are the differences there? Because you've got totally different winds and I would imagine tides and everything.
Well, and those, the two areas you mentioned, the south shore and north shore of Oahu, face in different directions, so they break during different seasons. That is, winter swells come from the North Pacific. You know, they're on the Aleutians. Big storms kick up swells, and those hit the North Shore and perhaps the West Shore too, but not the South. So, you know, in town in Honolulu, which is on the South Shore, it'll be basically quiet all winter, and meanwhile it's giant often on the North Shore. And then the opposite, although it doesn't get as giant. I mean, the storms that generate the swells that come to the South Shore tend to be in the higher latitudes in the Southern Hemisphere, so they're a long, long way away and, you know, thousands of miles, and it's much smaller by the time it gets to Hawaii.
What are the basic rules of, like, when waves break and the depth of the water, and, like, is there a predictability to it?
There's some sort of broad formulae, yeah. You know, waves are are generated by storms, and they radiate out from the storm center, and they travel across ocean however far. That's called a fetch. Well, that's really – fetch actually relates to wind. But they travel whatever distance to a shore where they break. And the formula for where the wave is going to break, I think it's usually about – half the depth, I think I have this right, of the height of the wave. I mean, these are things one kind of knows intuitively.
Yeah, you don't think about it much.
Rarely puts into words.
You don't have a calculator out there with you.
Right. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. But what happens is that the energy of a wave, which sort of circulates below the surface mainly and then is pushed above the surface as it approaches shore because the bottom is hitting the shore. And then as the bottom part of that energy drags on the bottom enough, sufficiently, the top topples forward. And that's how a wave breaks.
And the bottom of the ocean, I mean, is there, does it, what's the impact of having a big drop, you know?
That's a good question because if it's very gradual, like if you have a continental shelf that sticks way out, that really slows waves down, makes them more gentle, makes them smaller. But if you have deep water, like Hawaii, for instance, has no continental shelf, so you get big, big swells coming right in close to shore. And then if you have a big drop off, a sharp edge to the reef, the bottom part of that energy hits and the top lurches forward that much more violently and creates what we call a barrel or a tube, you know, breaks hollow and hard as opposed to crumbly and gradual.
Yeah. The photography is spectacular out there now with GoPro, these little mini, you know, cameras that can be on the board or even on the surfer. I mean, do you participate in that at all?
No, I haven't used GoPro, but I've surfed a lot with guys. They're, you know, ever more dangerous because they're
trying to impress the camera.
Yeah, this is for the movies. And you see they've often got it in their mouth or something where you can like bite and it's hard to take them seriously, you know. But here he comes with his GoPro and, you know, locked in his jaw and you better get out of his way because this is for posterity as opposed to your surfing. It's sort of annoying.
You grew up in Southern California and, of course, right near Hollywood. I mean, and Beach Boys, you know, helped popularize surf culture. Was that part of the allure for you?
Yes and no. I mean, I started surfing in the early 60s, so that was the first sort of big fad period.
Gidget, the movie Gidget.
All that, yeah. But I couldn't say any of that. I mean, maybe in some way it ushered me towards surfing. But no, among surfers, like the Beach Boys weren't. They didn't really do it for you. They didn't really express what we were doing. There was some surf music. Dick Dale and the Deltones, I remember in the early 60s, songs like Let's Go Trippin' and Miser Lou and some of the instrumentals, Wipeout, Pipeline, these pop hits that really were kind of close to what was going on in the water, but mostly not.
And was Hawaii more immune to all of that, being so far away? And it was a while ago.
Yeah, in a way it was. I mean, there is some like fundamental difference, and I really got this when I moved to Hawaii, that when I was a kid, this is not so true now, but surfers were kind of considered juvenile delinquents, and we weren't popular with school authorities. Cops in beach towns were quite rough on us, and so there was that. We were oppositional. But in Hawaii, it wasn't like that. It was really part of the place, surfing.
And we're going to come back and talk more with Bill Finnegan about his autobiography. It's called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Going to have him read a little bit of that, too, when we come back. And if you'd like to join us, it's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum at kqed.org. Leave a message on our Facebook page if you prefer, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Much more to come. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here. My guest this hour is Bill Finnegan. His book is called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. It's about to come out in paperback, and won the Pulitzer in the autobiography category in 2016. And if you'd like to join us with your surf stories, perhaps, or thoughts about the book or anything you've been hearing for the first part of this hour, give us a call. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum at kqed.org. Bill, I meant to ask you earlier to read a passage from the book, but let's do it now. And you want to set this up a little bit for us? What is this?
Sure. I'll just read a page or less. This is from a section of the book about a long, long surf trip that my friend Brian DeSalvatore and I took. I also a writer, surfer, and sort of a like after graduate school, and I ended up being gone nearly 4 years, kind of bumming around the South Pacific and Southeast Asia, Southern Africa, looking for waves. And this passage takes place on a little uninhabited island in West Fiji, where we had seen from a distance this incredible wave, like with binoculars from a bigger island. And so we got some fishermen to drop us off there, and we just camped. And there was no fresh water, so they came back, you know, once a week with supplies and water. And for a while there was no surf, and we were just sort of camping, you know, on the edge of the jungle. But this is when the waves were just starting to pulse. Okay, this is back in the 70s. On the fifth day, or maybe it was the sixth, we surfed. It was still too small, really, but we were so surf-starved by then that we scrambled out at the first hint of a swell. Thigh-high waves zipped down the reef, most of them too fast to make. If you could get in early, top turn, gather just enough speed that the hook didn't pass you by, and then set the right line, the waves seemed to lift the tail of the board and hurl it down the line, on and on and on, with the lip throwing just over your back continually, a critical moment that's normally no more than a moment, but that seemed to last, impossibly, for half a minute or more. The water got shallower and shallower, and even the best rides didn't end well. But the speed runs were dreamlike. I had never seen a wave peel so mechanically. As the tide peaked, something very odd happened. The wind quit, and the water, already extremely clear, became more so. It was midday, and the straight overhead sun rendered the water invisible. It was as if we were suspended above the reef, floating on a cushion of nothing, unable even to judge the depth unless we happened to kick a coral head. Approaching waves were like optical illusions. You could look straight through them, at the sky and sea bottom behind them. And when I caught one and stood up, it disappeared. I was flying down the line, but all I could see was brilliant reef streaming under my feet. It was like surfing on air. The wave was so small and clear that I couldn't distinguish the wave face from the flats in front of the wave, from the flats behind the wave. It was all just clear water. I had to surf by feel. This was truly dreamlike. When I felt the wave accelerate, I crouched for speed, and suddenly I could see it again, because the waist-high crest, seen from down there, was higher than the horizon. The trades puffed, the surface riffled, and the hyperclarity was gone. The tide dropped, and we were back on the beach.
Bill Finnegan reading from Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. I'm wondering how difficult or different was it for you in writing this book compared with the other reporting you've done, the other journalism you've done, in terms of finding your voice? Was it harder? Was it easier? Was it just different?
In many ways, it was harder. I write about politics and you know, it's other people to the front. I'm there as the observer interviewing, trying to figure out what's going on. And in a memoir, it's kind of, you know, you to the front.
You don't strike me as a I'll be in front kind of person. You're very low key.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure I have friends who would disagree, or enemies. I really did. I mean, a lot of the editing was editors saying, okay, yes, this person you met was very interesting, but we don't need 5 pages about why this guy is so interesting. You know, back to you. And that was strange. And you mentioned sort of finding a voice. It changed over time. I had different models at different points in the, as I said, it took 20 years to write. So there were many runs at it and sort of false starts and then times when I just put it down. It was one of the ways it was difficult to write was the kind of lack of urgency to it. I mean, most of the stuff I write about, war and serious crises of one kind or another has its own built-in urgency. You know, I have to get this piece written. It's important to get this down.
Get this out to the world.
Yeah, it's serious problems and it kind of propels and justifies itself. Whereas, you know, writing about my hobby just could feel pretty lightweight in the midst of that. I mean, and at the same time, it was easier in the sense that, and that would cause me to put it down, but it was easier in the sense that I kind of loved meditating on this stuff and remembering it. And I actually had to do a lot of reporting. I mean, memoir is a very weird genre for a reporter because you have to kind of go out and investigate your memories. and find out how many of them are like wrong. You completely.
Did you check with your friends?
Oh yeah, lots of just trying to find the people who are there, and the whole business of, you know, this is private life we're talking about, right? Nothing was
interior
on the record.
Yeah,
yeah, and this, these are, you're giving yourself license to depict all these shared unguarded moments with friends and loved ones, usually many years later, and that is a big irrigation. You know, you've got to really think hard about what you can put in and what you need to leave out.
Were there things that, you know, you would have liked to put in that for either because a friend you ran it by said, no, please don't write about that, or you just felt like you needed to protect their privacy or their memory or whatever it was?
Yeah, both of those happened quite a bit. And then you have to make the judgment call. You know, you don't know how people are going to feel. No, there's no chance that everybody depicted in a book like this is going to be happy with their depiction, but lots of negotiation, and especially negotiation to get to the truth. What actually happened? What do you remember? What do I remember? Where's the archival? What does your journal say? And trying to, you know, and I'm sure I got plenty of things wrong.
Yeah. But. And you wrote a lot of letters too to your friend. Was it Dominic, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Back and forth when you moved to Hawaii. I mean, you wrote every day. You were.
Yeah. The letters I got returned were a big source. I mean, journals too, and other people's journals. But when I was sort of stuck, not sure how to proceed with the book, I got out of the blue a packet of letters from my old friend Dominic, my best friend in high school and junior high. And it turned out I hardly remembered this, but when we moved to Hawaii, I was 13, and I just wrote to him. He was back on the mainland. I was telling him about the surf and this, my school and all, you know, the excitement of living in Hawaii. And there were dozens of letters in this packet. His mother had kept them. It was like 40 years later. And hundreds of pages of, you know, longhand letters. And they were such, I mean, they were embarrassing to read. The writing was terrible. They're full of just nonsense. And some, you know, stuff I didn't know whether I could trust. You know, that sounds exaggerated. Really, the current carried us all the way to Cocoa Head? I don't think so. But mostly they were just this, it was like the, you know, Proustian Madeleine. I just bit into it and there it was. It all came back to me. And those, and I said, this is the first chapter about starting in this new school in Hawaii. And those letters really form the backbone of that first chapter.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And Neil in San Francisco, you've been extraordinarily patient waiting to be on with Bill Finnegan. Welcome.
Yeah, two questions. First, are there any other serious books or movies about surfing that you know of? And the second question is, there don't seem to be any black surfers. Do you know why?
Well, I'll take the second question first. There aren't, you're right, a lot of African-American surfers, if you're just speaking of the U.S. And there was a guy in Los Angeles who was one of the pioneers at Malibu, a black guy, who was kind of revered there. He's before my time, and I can't recall his name, but I used to hear stories about him. He drowned, and he was a sort of pioneer of a crowd that never appeared. It was quite a white sport, at least where I grew up in Southern California. But in Hawaii, where I also grew up, that wouldn't be true at all. I mean, it's majority of people there aren't white. There are all kinds of different ethnicities and mixed ethnicities, you know, and a lot of Polynesians. And then in other countries, it just depends where you go, of course. But if you're in Barbados, for instance, a place where a lot of people on the East Coast like to go to surf, it's the local surfers are all black. That varies, but in general, it's, I mean, I used to think that it was mainly rich kids that surfed in poor countries, you know, and I spent a lot of time in Central America, for instance, and all these must be the kids of local and, elite, that are out here. But the more I've surfed in Mexico and Central America and other countries that are quite poor, the more, I've get to know local surfers who come from very modest backgrounds and surf really well and sometimes get ahead by doing so, you know, become pro surfers or something. So it's a sort of class stratified and racially stratified kind of sport, but not as bad as I used to think it was.
And were the groups of mostly guys that surfed in, say, Hawaii, was it divided by class and race and ethnicity?
No, not that I ever saw. I mean, you kind of hear that and then it wasn't true. In my long experience in Hawaii, you know, you're surfing with all kinds of different guys. This guy's got a PhD in oceanography and this guy didn't finish high school and they're, you know, they share this spot. They're both locals.
Yeah.
Now it's quite a a mix that way. And as for other books, I don't know. I might taste
movies, I think you said too.
Or movies. There's just about every movie made with surfing in it, I think, doesn't work. There's something about surfing in movies that tends to like collapse the drama. One exception perhaps is one crossover from surfing to the mainstream was a documentary in the 60s called Endless Summer. Some people probably remember it. It had a huge influence on me about, you know, two surfers who travel around the world. And it's actually kind of ironic the influence it had on me and my whole generation, thinking, you know, when I grow up, I have to do this, travel around the world and find waves. And I did that. But I realized later looking at it that the documentary wasn't really a documentary. I mean, the filmmaker was going to do this trip, and he hired a couple of, you know, top surfers of the day to go with him. So, and it was a few weeks, you know, it wasn't, you know, 4 years or however long one, that's how, you know, how long I took. And it wasn't the trip one imagined it was, you know, it was a film project. But my favorite books tend to be really technical. I mean, I love Matt Warshaw's History of Surfing and Matt Warshaw's Encyclopedia of Surfing and Bill Cleary and David Stern's Surfing Guide to Southern California. I mean, they're really kind of technical books for obsessives as opposed to for the general reader.
All right, Neil, thanks very much for the call. What do you make of the sort of superstar surfers? And I'm blanking on his name, Slater?
Kelly Slater.
Kelly,
yeah.
Slater, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, has that been good for the sport, do you think? Sort of the commercialization of it?
Well, I don't find it very exciting, no. I mean, I, like everybody, love to watch Kelly Slater surf and other people who can surf nearly as well. And I watch contests online, the whole thing, you know, waste my time. But the great, great majority of surfers don't compete and pretty much never see a contest. You can easily go your whole life surfing and never see a contest or have anything to do with it. It's really over the, kind of the edge. And as part of, as you say, the commercialization, the kind of use of surfing imagery to sell anything and everything. You just see surf pictures and video and lots of sort of nonsense about so that has nothing to do with surfing itself, but is meant to evoke, you know, feelings in people that will cause them to buy whatever you're selling. And that's a little grim for, I mean, surfing keeps growing and growing and growing in popularity. And I think I could safely speak for most surfers saying we wish that would stop because it's really crowded in the water. We wish surfing would become uncool and just like, you know, like rollerblading or something. People just turn away.
Well, your book's not going to help.
I think it might actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I've been surprised the number of people who've said, who read it and said, you know, I always thought I might try surfing. Now I know I won't.
It's too hard.
Yeah, they get what the thing itself is, which is years and years and years of kind of obsessive and like the difficulty of actually having a life while you surf. Once people get that, they realize it's not something they're going to learn in a week in Costa Rica.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Again, the number, if you want to talk to Bill Finnegan, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or shoot us an email. It's forum@kqed.org. And Mountain View is our next stop. David, welcome.
Hey, thank you. I just want to say I really enjoyed reading the book, and the San Francisco Ocean Beach section alone was worth the price of it. I don't think you see Ocean Beach written about very often, probably because it's not surfable very often, but I think you captured it very well, and that was very enjoyable.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. It was. I first wrote about Ocean Beach actually in a magazine piece for The New Yorker, and then had to adapt that section to the book, and it was a kind of small surf community in the 80s when I lived here in San Francisco and was surfing out there, and it's a lot more people surf it now. But it's still gratifying. I mean, it's so hard to paddle out there just to get from the beach to where you can ride waves. You know, it's called the lineup when the waves are bigger in the winter when they're good. And it's really, now that it's better known and some top pros, you know, Slater, but other people show up here on a good swell and surf it. It's sort of gratifying to hear them interviewed afterwards saying, that's the hardest paddle out I've ever done in my life. 50 waves broke on my head. You know, that was just, and you feel just, yes, I was right. It was really as hard as I thought it was.
David, are you a surfer?
I am. And I also, being an older surfer, find it inspirational how you keep your conditioning and your drive going.
Oh, thanks. I'm getting worse every year.
As am I.
All right. Thanks, David, for the call. What's the hardest, what are the toughest things about surfing at your age, 63?
Weirdly, it's small waves. In New York, it gets quite good in the winter around New York City, but it's often small, quick beach break. And of course, you're wearing a lot of rubber, a heavy wetsuit for the winter there. And just that, the timing, you have to be so sort of quick, strong, right on it, catching waves, popping to your feet, everything, even booties and gloves and all that. My sister lives in Hawaii, and I try to go there every winter, and it's just such a liberation and a relief to get there, and the waves are bigger, and you're not wearing...
Water's warmer.
Yeah, you're not wearing a wetsuit, and suddenly I realize, I can still surf. You know?
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we'll stay down the peninsula there. Tom in Los Gatos, welcome.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Great show. Thanks for my calls. I was watching the pipeline competition 2015 a couple of weeks ago on TV. I guess it was from the winter before or fall before this year. But anyway, the waves are up to 60 feet, the face of the waves.
Wow.
Really some great runs. But they interviewed a young surfer, maybe 15 or 16, and asked him what he thought about the whole thing. And he mentioned the houses there on the North Shore facing pipeline. And he said there's a lot of criminality going on, people getting choked out and beaten up, and even had stripper poles, he said, in at least one of the houses. So, and he also said that their boys, 9 years old, apprentice surfers living in houses full time. So I was wondering what kind of supervision, from the hated police even is going on there at the North Shore surf houses. You know, some of our big name, houses, like Target and Rip Curl and so on, too. So it's a lot of money involved.
Yeah, I don't know. There are some infamous sponsor houses along that stretch of beach, although they're infamous for various things. I haven't heard about the 9-year-olds with the stripper poles, but I have heard about some of the kind of military regimen and the hierarchy of who gets a bed and who sleeps on the floor. And the pros tend to stay in those houses when they're there for contests or just there for the season. But that contest that ends the year, it's called the Pipe Masters, is often really dramatic. It sort of decides the world championship. It's a great wave. But it's surfing so strange as a it's really barely described as a sport. I remember watching, we were talking about Kelly Slater, 11-time world champion, and after one of his victories at Pipe Masters, when he won yet another world championship, I saw him interviewed on the beach, like straight after, walking up the beach. Oh, Kelly, you've just won, $50,000 or whatever it was. And of course, he was excited, but he kept turning and looking back at the surf. And as soon as the contest was over, like the public was allowed in, so all these guys are paddling into the lineup. But the waves were incredible, and he'd been just out with one other guy in the final. And he kept sort of turning away from the interviewer and looking, like he couldn't concentrate on the question because he had to watch the next wave. Look at that. At one point, the guy said something. I'm just, paraphrasing here, but he said, like, Kelly, you just won, $50,000. And Slater said, you could have your $50,000 back. Just give me another half hour out there with one other guy. And any surfer could relate to that. I mean, not that you'd be able to surf it. It's extremely heavy stuff. But,
or give up the $50,000.
But yeah, he could afford, I suppose. But his sort of look on his face was so familiar, and he was just electrified by the waves and being able to surf with just one other person. And I mean, you can't imagine any other sport. You come off the NBA championship game and say, oh, just give me a half hour more to play basketball. It's just not the same.
All right, Tom, thanks for the call. I was struck in reading the book about some parallels with you and Barack Obama. Obama grew up in Hawaii, didn't surf, but then came to Southern California, you went the other way. I'm just wondering if by chance you happen to have ever thought about that or talked with him about that in your reporting?
Not that specifically. I did write a profile of him once upon a time before he was very famous and I really liked and admired him and think he's been a great president too. But sort of after hours one night, I started kidding him about the school he went to in Honolulu. It's called Punahou.
Puno,
it's like
very
the famous. Yeah, it's like the fancy private school there. And I went to a public junior high. But I was really kind of very pointedly kidding him about Punahou. And he said, what are you talking about? What do you know about Punahou? And I told him, I went to Kaimuki Intermediate. And he said, no effing way. You can't, he was pretty strongly spoken for Obama. So we has, sort of have that. And he's actually a good body surfer.
Is he?
Yeah. Yeah. He's
never
body
heard him talk about that.
Yeah, he doesn't. He used to surf Sandy Beach, which is a heavy spot. And
he goes out, they go up to the North Shore around Christmas time every year.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have seen them, his party up there too, on the Mokulea side of the North Shore. But he was a Sandy Beach local. That's a heavy spot.
Talking with Bill Finnegan about his book, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. This is a pledge period in public radio and here at KQED. If you'd like to support what we do, you can go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And we've got some social media comments here as well, Bill. Catherine writes, my 83-year-old father, Dick Sears, passed away about 6 weeks ago. Dad loved to talk about surfing. And we had many chats about Barbarian Days, in fact. Dad started surfing in the mid-40s. He knew about the breaks described in the book, and it gave him great joy reliving those experiences. Thanks for a beautifully written book.
Oh, that's nice. That's really nice.
And here's something from Sabrina. She writes, Dear Mr. Finnegan, please consider writing an article for The New Yorker about inequality in big wave surfing. You write about politics. Why not write about the politics of surfing? It's time women athletes had an opportunity to compete at Mavericks.
I don't know much about competition or even Mavericks, although I was there this past winter, I guess, mid-December. I happened to be there, got there late in the day on a really big day, a lot of people out, and it really looks scary. I've never surfed there.
Yeah, and actually, I got a note here from the producer who writes that there has never been a woman competing in the final round at Mavericks, and the California Coastal Commission recently asked Mavericks officials to come up with a plan to include women.
Uh-huh. Well, there are a bunch of women who surf out there, and I was struck this big day, as I said, that I happened to stop there, watching people come in, and it was huge. I mean, I would not have paddled out there, and I ended up walking back to the parking lot behind four young women, a couple of whom I recognize are pros, all carrying big wave boards and wet and just absolutely giddy with, you know, we surfed it, we survived, and they're planning their next night. Where they were going to surf that winter. That was early in the winter, and they were off to Maui, this place, Peahi or Jaws, and which board they were going to, you know. I was just sort of in awe of these girls. I mean, a couple of them were really pretty young, and as I say, a couple of them I recognize. So there are women who charge giant waves, and I don't know how well they'd fare against the men, but they could certainly fill a final and have their own contest.
Yeah. I was thinking as I read that email from the woman whose father died recently that in your book, toward the end, you talk about your parents both passed away within the last 6 or 7 years, I think. And you write that at that point you became more reckless, you noticed, in your reporting and reporting on things like human trafficking and I think organized crime in Mexico. What was the connection there, do you think?
Well, I, in general, have become less reckless, I hope. I've got a 14-year-old daughter, and when she was born, I kind of swore off war reporting and various things I was doing that seemed like a parent shouldn't do. You know, they're kind of a young person's game. And yeah, I think maybe in grief, I did a couple of dumb things and attributed that to a certain kind of edge of despair about maybe my mother dying or my father. I don't remember what that passage was about exactly, but I was in general more inclined to be more responsible and not take stupid chances.
Yeah, did your parents were they supportive of your surfing when
yes.
you were young?
Yeah, they weren't particularly interested in it. Although my dad always took credit for my surfing in the sense that because of this incident he remembered better than I did, I guess, when I was young and trying to learn in Ventura. And I came in and we didn't have good wetsuits. I was freezing. I was a skinny little kid and I was kind of cut up and discouraged. And he was, you know, sitting warm in the car in his fisherman's sweater smoking a pipe. And he said, go back out and get three more. And I said, no. And I was crying. And he, yes, go back. You can't get in the car till you. So I, you know, angrily went back out and caught three more waves. And he always said, that's the day you became a surfer. You know, you never would have made it if it hadn't been. I didn't buy that
didn't
one
buy it at
bit,
all.
But made a little story. He liked it.
All right, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Michael in Concord, welcome.
Hey, guys, thanks for taking my call. This has been a great show. I just want to say, Mr. Finnegan, thanks for writing Crossing the Line. I read that book in 93, and actually that book sent me to South Africa for a year teaching English like you and surfing in Port Alfred. So I credit all that to you. and I followed your books. I just read Barbarian Days in the summertime, so it was awesome. You're just a real inspiration with your writing. So you sent another surfer to South Africa to teach. Do you still keep in touch, or kind of have you been back to South Africa? And I'll take my answer off the air, but thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for the inspiration. Thanks for the comment.
Oh, thank you. That's amazing. I didn't realize I'd sent anyone to South Africa. I'm glad you had a good time. Yeah, my mother-in-law lives in Cape Town. I get back there pretty often. I haven't done any reporting there for a while, and actually haven't been there as much as I'd like to. And I'm hoping to go back later this year. I do stay in touch with some of the people who were depicted in that book, Crossing the Line, which is about a year that I spent teaching high school outside Cape Town. And I just got a long, complicated review of my book from the woman who in that book I call Maddie. She is a grown-up now and a really good reader and really read this book closely and takes me to task. I've got to find a way to reply in a fitting with a fitting complexity to her review. If you remember her from the book, you know what I'm talking about.
All right. Bill Finnegan, thanks so much for coming in today to talk about your book. It's coming out in paperback soon, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Thanks so much. And you're going to be tonight at Bookshop West, the Bookshop on West Portal, rather, at 7 p.m. Tomorrow you're going to be at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley at 7:30. So folks can go out and hear you read somewhere. Maybe we'll read that passage about Ocean Beach. Who knows?
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.